Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Char. On this week's podcast, turn off the lights, go vegetarian, and reuse nappies. Easy ways to save the environment. Or are they?
Flowers flown into the UK from Kenya can actually have a far smaller carbon footprint than equivalent flowers grown in a heated greenhouse in Holland.
We look more closely at the truth behind some eco claims. Plus, what role can religion play in the battle to save the planet?
The nine-year plan has the potential to reach 900 million Hindus.
There are 3.4 billion people in the world who follow religions which view Jerusalem as holy to them.
Also, one of the authors of the Kyoto Protocol tells us what needs to happen at Copenhagen.
You can see this North-South conflict as what amounts to a cold war on emissions between China and the United States. Doing something about emissions is too late for that. Now you have to physically get personal and up close with those molecules in the atmosphere and bring them down.
And why Britain's renewable energy targets are physically impossible to achieve. This is a particularly green-tinged edition of Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome, everyone. Once again, we've got the Observer's science editor, Robin McKee, here in the pod. Hi, Robin.
Hi.
Also here is The Guardian's Duncan Clark.
Hello.
Duncan works on The Guardian's environment site and is also author of The Rough Guide to Green Living, which we're going to talk about just in a moment. Before we kick off, though, let me ask you both. We're going to talk about T-Rex a bit later and how, as paleontologists discover more about these amazing dinosaur creatures, that we just find that they're a bit different to what we thought. Now, if you could change something in the historical record about dinosaurs, what would you change, Duncan?
I think I'd have to change the very fact that they went extinct.
What? And, you want them walking around?
When I was doing a bit of Googling on dinosaurs earlier, and I found a number of rather conspiratorial sites which claimed that dinosaurs did still exist in the depths of the Amazon and elsewhere. So it'd be nice to believe that there were a couple of small ones out there.
And they were blogging from there, were they, or something?
Yes. Okay.
Robin?
Yeah, well, I like to keep them alive as well, and I think the way to do that is to give them opposable thumbs, and that would have changed everything. And, you know, we'd have velociraptors that could open fridge doors, as they almost could in Jurassic Park, and then they would evolve, they'd start making tools and they'd start cooperating, and the next thing you know, big brains and woof, no us.
And are you sure? Maybe they've evolved into something very similar to humans. I mean, I think I know people who are velociraptor types. In human form.
We've worked with them all, haven't we, really?
let's move on to the environment as it stands today and eco-claims. Now, Duncan's book, The Rough Guide to Green Living, is about things that they don't tell you about green living. So in a G2 article recently, he listed a whole bunch of things which you might think are environmentally friendly, but turn out to have some unexpected consequences. Now, Duncan, before we go into this stuff, you spend most of your time persuading people to join up to things like 1010, cut their carbon emissions, be environmentally friendly. Why do you want to tell people that being green is not necessarily what you think?
Well, because ultimately, when we try to be green, we're in large part trying to combat climate change, and we're not going to achieve that if the things that we set out to do are well-meaning but not particularly well-informed. So what I'm trying to do here is explain what really works and what doesn't.
So you've got 10 things here which all on the surface are eminently sensible things. I'm sure that we at The Guardian have written in many ways about how to reduce your carbon footprint and included all these 10 things. So, for example, let's go for number one, turning off the lights saves CO2. Now, I do that religiously, and I tell everyone I know, I go around this building even, turning off lights. But you reckon that doesn't actually save much CO2?
Well, it's a complicated one, and it's one that a lot of people are loath to really engage with. But the fact is that the entire UK power sector, along with many other heavy polluting industries in Europe, the entire emissions of that sector is set in advance by a mechanism called the European Emissions Trading Scheme. The ETS, to use the shorthand, serves to try and reduce emissions over the coming years from these various sectors. But in order to do that, it sets the emission cap in advance and then allows companies to trade between themselves the carbon permits that they've been allocated. What this means, although it's slightly hard to get your head around, is that if we all switch the lights off, the UK electricity sector requires less permits, fewer permits. In turn, that means that those permits will be freed up to be used elsewhere in the system. So if the UK power sector produces less CO2, a German cement plant, for example, might end up producing more.
And the idea is that, of course, that also if the the UK power company uses fewer CO2 permits, that the price of those permits eventually would fall as well. So it'd be cheaper for someone else to pollute a bit more.
Yeah, you could make that case. I mean, the fact is, ultimately, the price should affect the rate at which people make decisions about carbon-intensive activities. But ultimately, if the total number of tons of CO2 is set in advance, then whatever happens to the price shouldn't make much difference to that. And so ultimately, we just need to be aware that if we really want to turn the lights off and make a difference, we need to take an extra step, which is to actually remove an equivalent number of permits from the ETS. And that's something we can do through groups like sandbag.org.uk. Whether many people will be sufficiently motivated remains to be seen.
Okay, well, if turning off the lights doesn't save the CO2, what about if I switch my energy provider to, you know, something like Good Energy or those places that commit to producing nothing but renewable energy? They don't come and put a wind farm outside my house, but I mean, isn't that a good thing?
Well, again, I mean, there are reasons why you may want to sign up with a company like that. A company specializing in renewables is likely to be, you know, lobbying the government for stronger targets rather than less strict targets. But if you're being won over by the simple argument that the energy you buy from that point on will suddenly be from green sources, then you are slightly having the wool pulled over your eyes, because roughly speaking, the government requires every energy provider to produce a certain amount of its electricity from renewable sources. If a company doesn't meet that target, it has to buy permits from someone else who has produced too much. What you find then is that even a company that advertises itself as supplying only 100% renewable electricity will be selling that electricity to you, but then selling the vast majority of the clean energy permits that come with that electricity to other companies, which then don't have to produce the electricity from green sources themselves. So what you're looking at really is a case of double accounting, where you think you're adding to the amount of renewable electricity being produced, but according to most experts who have looked at this, you're not really.
Robin, what caught your eye on this list?
Oh, number nine. This is the cracker as far as I'm concerned.
Reusable nappies.
Yes. I mean, all those poor people that bought renewable nappies and had spent their lives in their...
Renewable nappies, I like that.
And, you know, they're surrounded with baby crap and smell, and really it was absolutely for nothing at all. And those of us who, you know, have been fathers and... being parents, you've been and using disposables and feeling guilty about it. In fact, weren't doing any harm at all. I feel quite smug about
that one. What's the story on that one?
Well, again, what I'm focusing on first and foremost is climate change. And if you look at nappies from a purely climate change perspective, how much carbon is produced in the creation and disposal and use of these nappies, then you do find that if you use them in a typical way, then the reusable ones are not any better and, in general, actually a little bit worse. The carbon footprint will be greater. That is a slight oversimplification, of course, because climate change isn't the only issue. We've also got things like landfill, which many people have an environmental problem with. And, of course, if you use disposable nappies, you'll be sending a far larger volume of waste to landfill. You'll also use more oil, which there may be a disadvantage in doing. But ultimately, if you're interested in the carbon footprint, then your reusable nappies will only be greener if you go out of your way to use them in a green manner. That would mean not having too many of them, for example, washing them at 60 degrees rather than boil washing them, hanging them on the line rather than tumble drying, not using a nappy cleaning service. They have the highest carbon footprint of all. And indeed, if you have more than one child, then saving those nappies for the next one rather than producing a whole lot more cotton after throwing away your first batch.
See, the thing I don't get, Robin, maybe you can explain it as a dad. Why can't you just teach kids to go to the toilet? I mean, we found this amazing way.
Well, that is the battle of the first few years, I've found.
Duncan, what about on that front, cleaning nappies and things, detergents? If you're going to have to clean, if you decide you want to use these renewable nappies, as we're going to call them from now on, and you want to wash them, use ecological detergents.
Well, again, there are some good reasons to use ecological detergents. These products grew up when there were concerns about toxic chemicals in cleaning products, some of them bioaccumulative, building up through the food chain. So there are good reasons to favour products that are based on easily biodegradable, minimally toxic, usually plant-based chemicals instead. However, when you look at the carbon footprint of a product such as a washing up liquid or indeed a shampoo or anything else like that, what you find is that the vast majority of the footprint is not in the manufacture and distribution of that product, but it's in the hot water that's used with it. So if it comes back to climate change versus other issues. If you're interested in reducing your carbon footprint, the thing you need to focus on first and foremost is using less hot water. If you can achieve that whilst continuing to use eco detergents, eco washing up liquids, etc., then that's a win-win situation. But if, as some people find, when you put your clothes on at 30 degree wash and they're very dirty and you're using an eco detergent, they don't come out as clean as you'd like, then arguably it's better to keep the dial down and use a stronger detergent than to up the temperature dial and to stick with the eco one.
Robin, one of the things that seems to have come up from Duncan's list is this battle between what's ethically good to do, you know, use perhaps fewer chemicals that might harm the environment, versus what's environmentally friendly from a climate change point of view. And these things are not always the same thing.
No, and the good example perhaps is the very last one on the list is the buying local. Yes, some ways it's ethically good to buy local produce, but it's not necessarily the green option. If we think about, say, whether should we bring our vegetables in from Kenya, beans from Kenya, that seems a silly thing to do, to fly them from Kenya. But in fact, of course, when they're grown in Kenya, they use organic manure and they don't use petrol. They're hand picked. You don't use tractors. On the other hand, you're also keeping people in jobs out there. However, you're also using up a great deal of the water, and some of the main lakes in Kenya are going to suffer devastating losses of water, which affects the local ability to grow food. So it's an incredibly complex thing, and you're quite right, the green living doesn't necessarily equate with ethical living.
Are there situations though, Duncan, where buying from another country is climate change wise better for as well as being ethically better?
Well, certainly groups like Oxfam would say that there are examples which where you can help developing world farmers and at the same time be buying a less carbon intensive product. There are basically no rules in this particular area. Sometimes something that comes from a long way away will have a larger carbon footprint, especially if it's been flown, whereas very often it will have a smaller carbon footprint. I mean, to give one example, a much-cited study that came out a few years ago claimed that lamb from New Zealand that was consumed in the UK actually had a lower carbon footprint than British lamb consumed in the UK. The reason that they have more rich pastures in New Zealand and they have cleaner electricity that drives much of the systems behind the agriculture. Therefore, the 20,000-mile shipping, or however far it would be, is actually a fairly insignificant component. Similarly, in a study by Cranfield University showed that flowers flown into the UK from Kenya can actually have a far smaller carbon footprint than equivalent flowers grown in a heated greenhouse in Holland, for the simple reason that whereas in Kenya you have all this natural sunlight and you have, in some cases, soils where you wouldn't need to use a great deal of artificial fertilizer, in Holland you have neither of those things, especially in the winter. So, in short, if you think that the flowers grown in Kenya were fairly traded and that they were offering a benefit to the people in that area, then that would be an example of a double win. But it's one of those points of debate where no one really can reach consensus, and partly because it's all just so complicated.
Duncan, thanks very much. We'll leave it there for now. Duncan's book, The Rough Guide to Green Living, is out now, including this fascinating fact that apparently hard cheese, which apparently takes a lot of milk to produce, has a bigger carbon footprint per kilo than chicken, which I think is very exciting given that we're supposed to turn vegetarian for climate change. I knew there would be a study that showed that that wasn't necessarily true. Let's have a look now at some of the science stories around this week.
Britain's renewable energy targets are physically impossible. A new study by the Institution of Mechanical Engineers calls for the government to adopt a wartime mentality in their approach to dealing with climate change. It also urges experimental approaches, such as artificial trees that soak up carbon dioxide, in order to buy the time needed to build the required level of low carbon infrastructure in the UK.
Scientists have developed a revolutionary surgical treatment that could allow women with cancer to regrow their breasts after a mastectomy. Human trials for the procedure, which scientists hope could replace breast reconstructions and implants, will start within 3 to 6 months. It involves inserting a biodegradable chamber into the woman's chest, within which permanent fat found in breasts can grow.
A series of recent deaths of those involved in the 9/11 emergency response has heightened fears of cancer-related illnesses. Five New York firefighters and police officers, all of whom were involved in the rescue and clear-up at Ground Zero, have died in the past 3 months, the oldest being just 44. There are concerns it could be part of an epidemic.
If you thought dinosaurs were slow, lumbering creatures, then think again. A new study of their skeletons suggests dinosaurs like T-Rex were nimble, warm-blooded creatures. Researchers in St. Louis have been working out how much energy the animals might have needed to move around. It was found that the power their muscles needed was far too high for the animals to have been cold-blooded.
Okay, let's take a look at some of those stories now. Robin, this story about the stem cells growing into fat tissue to replace a woman's breasts, take us through what they actually did in that experiment.
These experiments were mostly carried out by animals to begin with to show that, standard procedure. I mean, basically you create what is a biodegradable bag or a sack that is placed in the woman's chest, and you put the stem cells that are fat tissue stem cells. So basically, the fat, which is the major content of breasts in the human species, grows within this sack, and then eventually, after several months, the sack will degrade and disappear. And the aim is you will have reconstructed the woman's breast, which she's lost in an operation after breast cancer, will be restored.
This is one of those things which stem cell scientists and people excited about stem cells have been kind of looking forward to. You're growing tissue, you're regenerating tissue that's been damaged in some way. And this is what the promise has been for a long time. Are we going to start seeing more of this sort of thing with stem cells?
Yes, I mean, yes, we are. When we're going to see more of this kind of science, when we actually see it as a procedure in a hospital is a different matter. As the scientists here based in Melbourne make very clear, this is still years away, although they are going to begin some of the techniques on humans, on women, obviously, within the next 6 months. But it still remains a more distant prospect for the simple reason that most organs that you want to regrow are very structured items, and therefore it's very difficult. You want to regrow a liver, you've actually got to have lots of different bits in the liver. You may be able to regrow the liver cells that you want, which have the chemical function that you're seeking and is missing in somebody who's had to have the liver removed. But you've still got to get all the supply, the structure, all the different parts of that organ. A woman's breast is, oddly enough, slightly easier because a great deal of fat tissue. It's a relatively simple compared to other organs.
I mean, the other things that have been grown are like a bladder, for example, which again is just a fairly simple thing. People have grown sheets of heart cells that beat, liver cells, sheets of them to maybe do toxicity tests, but not actually function as a liver. So it's the 3D structure of organs is incredibly complicated because the cells will talk to each other in different ways, which you've got no idea about if it's just a one-dimensional sheet.
Yes, and you've got to think about the various different types of stem cell that you would use in this.
How would the cells know to stop? I mean, so you put this biodegradable chamber in a breast, and is the idea that the body naturally fills any vacuum, and therefore it will continue generating cells until this biodegradable sac is full, and then after it's degraded, there'll be no further growth.
This has got to do with hormones, I guess, in some
yes,
way.
Yes, you have to signals. One of the things the scientists have to do is to find out what the off switch is. There has to be a chemical off switch there.
Because this is the danger that if you've got stem cells which can do these amazing things, if you don't know how to switch them off after the growing, they become cancerous. This is a sort of a terrible result of potentially trying to do some good. And this is also the issue with stem cells. Generally, we think we know a lot about them, but we actually know not that much at all when it comes to actually using them in human beings. They're nowhere near safe enough for that sort of purpose.
Quite.
Let's move on to renewable energy, something that Duncan, I'm sure you're a big fan of and know all the details about. But this is a story coming out of the Institution of Mechanical Engineers. On Friday last week, they published a study. It was one of a series of studies that they've been doing on engineering and climate. They did one recently on artificial trees and geoengineering and so on. But this one was sort of did sort of put everything together, and they came to this kind of interesting conclusion that Britain's legally binding targets to cut carbon emissions by, well, first 2020 and then by 2050 are virtually impossible to make given the amount of kit they need to make. So they just examined how much kit, how many wind turbines, nuclear power stations, biomass plants, solar PV things, all these things you would need to build to meet the 34% reduction in carbon emissions by 2020 and then the 80% by 2050. And they just thought, well, we haven't got the time. We could flat out put every single engineer onto this and we just can't build it. They gave examples, for example, of saying things like, looking at how long it takes to build a nuclear power station, which could be anything up to 10 years. It took 8 years to electrify a train line between London and Swansea, they said, so there's no way you're going to get 3,000 wind turbines. But another one was that the government wants to build thousands of wind turbines between now and 2020, a very, very laudable aim. The NGOs are very happy about this. But there aren't enough boats to take them out there and actually build these things. I mean, Duncan, is this surprising?
That particular conundrum about the lack of boats is something I've heard about a bit before. It's true that the bottleneck in offshore wind turbines, the biggest single one, is that you need a very specialist vessel to take out a turbine, to plant it on the bottom of the sea and to put it there in such a way that it will stay secure. And I think the figure I last read was that there are only two of these vessels in the entire world. And apparently some people are very rapidly trying to build some more.
We should set up a company. This is clearly where
Indeed.
It's going to be. That's an incredible sort of thing to have missed as a government, to sort of think that you could build this many things. And is there any thinking that you can just get around this some other way?
Well, some people believe that the rollout of micro renewables will be more significant than a lot of commentators currently believe. There was an interesting example of a Chinese company which stopped just selling solar panels and started selling solar panel factories, so that you can now buy off the shelf a factory which... prefabricated factory, which will then produce however many kilowatts of solar panels per day. And if, as some people in the solar industry believe, that prices continue to fall, capacity continues to rise thanks to that sort of company, then who knows, with the right incentives and low enough costs, we could see a really significant proportion of the UK's electricity coming from small sources.
I would have thought solar cells was the last thing that we would need in this country.
Well, apparently they'll still work, wouldn't they? Even
they
without direct
work.
Sunlight.
Yes, but it's not going to make a difference. I mean, there does seem to be a major mismatch between the government's aspirations and what it's actually going to do. By any account, by 2016, we're going to have insufficient electricity generation to meet the country's requirements for power.
Indeed.
The lights will go out.
There's also the argument that some of these problems can be got around by rethinking how we use the grid, and the government's commitment to put smart meters out by 2020 is part of this. And some interesting work is already going on in America and elsewhere about, for example, load shedding, where you say to a company, we'll reduce your electricity tariff by whatever percent if at the touch of a button we can turn your electricity off with no notice and you won't sue us. So you've already got companies in America now that are geared up to...
What do those companies do? Are they knitting factories or something?
Well, they're generally factories. Factories that can work 24 hours a day. It doesn't make a difference if they're off for an hour at 5 o'clock or 7 o'clock. And for those sorts of automated high energy production processes, it makes a lot of sense for them to be more flexible when they use power, and therefore to make the grid more flexible and more able to accommodate unreliable sources such as wind.
Robin, one of the things that the IMEC-E talked about was that if you want to cut carbon emissions by 80% by 2050, simply building all this kit is not going to do it. So what they suggested instead is that you need to invest in geoengineering. And this kind of the specific things that they talked about are these artificial trees being developed by Klaus Lackner at Columbia University, which suck out CO2 from the atmosphere. They talked about growing algae on the sides of buildings, which would also suck out CO2, but then also you could use it as a biomass fuel. And these things, they said, would by the time that we need to build all this low carbon infrastructure. Do you think that's a good way to go?
It strikes me a desperate way to go. And wait until things are too bad and then do this emergency action. And quite frankly, artificial trees sucking in carbon dioxide, given the amount of carbon dioxide that's going to be up there, it's laughable. Absolutely laughable.
Klaus Lackner, who I met recently, made the interesting point that if you look at the number of cars we produce every year, and however many hundreds of millions it is globally, if just 5% of those of that manufacturing capacity was put instead onto producing artificial trees, which take about the same amount of electricity and metals to produce, then we would have sufficient capacity to bring global concentrations of CO2 back down.
But why would I want to do? Where's the economics in that? I mean,
you know, what are you going to do with the CO2? That's the question.
Well, that's another discussion. But the interesting thing about these artificial trees, of course, is you can put them anywhere you like. So you can find the most suitable storage site in the world, stick them all there, and you don't have to worry about a huge pipeline infrastructure.
Okay. Well, to read more about all of this stuff, go to guardian.co.uk/science or /environment.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
The United Nations Secretary General wants to enlist religious leaders in the fight against climate change. Ban Ki-moon is urging them to set an example for the lifestyle of billions. He wants them to establish green places of worship, buy environmentally friendly goods, and invest in sustainable products. He spoke last week as part of a three-day summit on religion's role in climate change at Windsor Castle. We sent along Riazat Butt, our religious affairs correspondent, to speak to some of the delegates.
Richard Charters, I'm the Bishop of London. Well, if you don't believe the scientific evidence that's presented to you, you've really got problems, because it's no part of my belief as a Christian believer that I'm committed to believing in irrational things. I think one of the most remarkable things about the world in which we live is that it is perfectly possible to analyse it rationally and to observe predictable and repeatable laws. With the decline of religious faith in some parts of the world, what has resulted is not a glorious day for reason and liberation. It's actually a new credulity. People are credulous. They believe in absolutely any rubbish. And what you say does worry me a good deal, because it does appear that there are numbers of people who simply refuse to believe the evidence of reputable scientists.
Shonika Rishidas, I'm director of the Oxford Centre for Hindu Studies.
What kind of steps are in your nine-year plan?
Well, the first thing is the nine-year plan has the potential to reach 900 million Hindus around the world. 20 million of them are in diaspora, and a lot of them are in America, in England, in Australia, the wealthiest and most and best educated ethnic group. So these potentially potently powerful people, influential in their communities. We're starting off with organic milk. We're saying drink organic milk. Why? Because it's less cruel to the cows and it's more wholesome for your body, but you know, better for the planet. After that, we want to do an ahimsa labeling for milk so that we have cruelty-free milk, which will be good for vegans and Hindus and Jains and Buddhists and Sikhs. We're going to encourage all the temples to develop organic temple gardens to be good practice to their communities, but also they're the gardens from which you offer the food in the temple. And if they can't grow it, to source it within 30 miles of the area.
My name is James Morant, and I'm with the Global Policy Committee of New Psalmist Baptist Church.
Is it easy being green?
No, it's not. If you say climate change is a theoretical kind of issue, people understand it, but they don't understand it in their gut. But if you say, I now have West Nile virus because the mosquitoes are moving farther north in the United States, and that's because of climate change, or potentially because of climate change, then that's relevant. That's a day-to-day activity. If you say, to get my McDonald's hamburger, I have to use up 5 inches of topsoil, then perhaps that's relevant to me.
I'm Rabbi Yedidiah Sinclair. I live in Jerusalem, and I'm co-founder of the Jewish Climate Campaign.
Now, how much progress is being made in Jerusalem?
We have a really ambitious but doable 7-year plan for greening Jerusalem and turning it into a model sustainable city. And that's a very powerful thing, because there are 3.4 billion people in the world who follow religions which view Jerusalem as holy to them. And millions of pilgrims and tourists come every year. So the experience of coming to Jerusalem was one of coming to an outstanding sustainable city, then that would could be really transformative for those people.
Science Weekly.
A quick bit of feedback from recent weeks now. We're using actors to protect these people's identities. On last week's blog, Havoc writes,
"Good podcast, guys. Thoroughly enjoyable.
Always a good way to start, I think.
The most important point is made in the show, that science is only a small part of policy making and politics plays a large part. If scientists are employed by ministers, then they should definitely not criticise the minister's decisions in public. The truth is that politicians know best, because they're far more in touch with the public and their constituencies than any scientist or bureaucrat."
On Facebook, this is from Jonathan Mackenzie Stanton.
"Hey, I love the podcast. It makes my week, as I live in Ecuador now and TV is not great. There are tons of soap operas. It seems like a lot of people think to cut CO2 is looking difficult. Well, listen to this. Ecuador cut power consumption by 35% within just 24 hours of taking the decision, by rationing electricity. They pulled the plug, and we live in the capital city, and we're getting our electricity cut daily for 4 hours every single day. I now cook the kids' dinner on a portable gas stove with candlelight. You know what? The kids love it. Never seen them eat so well. I'm not saying it'd be so easy in the UK, as it gets a little cold there, but we live at 3,000 metres and it gets pretty cold here sometimes. Just wanted to say that anything is possible."
And Colin Smith says it was good to listen to Dave Delpy from the EPSRC.
"When you touched upon the issue of making the most of taxpayers' money, assessing the impact of research to the economy, society, UK PLC, etc., via the upcoming Research Excellence Framework, I was willing you to stray into the area of open access to research. I think this would make an interesting topic for a future podcast."
Following our Uranium Wars programme, Mike Westy confidently boasts that he knows what the critical mass of radioactive material is for one of those big bombs. Just keep it to yourself, Mike. On Twitter, @podcast_review says the podcast is a nice recent discovery. And Jen Middleton says,
"I'm loving the Geordie accent and the pigeon story in last week's news jam."
Either join our Facebook group and post a comment on the wall, or leave your thoughts on the blog at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. On Twitter, you can search for Guardian Science or Science Weekly.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
Back in 1997, 160 nations signed the Kyoto Protocol, an attempt to do something to curb global greenhouse gas emissions. Whether or not that's been a success is up for debate, but the deal expires in 2012, which is one of the reasons why so much emphasis is being placed on next month's UN Climate Change Summit in Copenhagen. Graciela Chicholdneski, a professor of maths and economics at Columbia University, helped create the carbon market proposed in the Kyoto Protocol, and which became international law in 2005. She was also on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change when they drafted the protocol. She came into the pod to discuss what she thinks should happen at Copenhagen, where legislators will agree a successor to the Kyoto Protocol.
At the 11th and a half hour, when the protocol was essentially failing, they couldn't reach agreement. But they needed the wording that would pass by the Europeans. So I went in and it was like a theater, like with steps, and they were all sitting at their seats. And I sat on the steps, actually, and I started to write. And I wrote words that were so mild that eventually the Europeans let it through. And that's how the Kyoto Protocol was signed.
So you saved the Kyoto Protocol once already?
I didn't think of it that way, but I suppose you could say that, yes.
And now you want to save it again because 12 years on, the Kyoto, as it was negotiated then, is poised to expire, or the first phase is going to expire in 2012, and the world is trying to agree a successor. We keep talking about Copenhagen. Just tell us what one of the big obstacles is to a deal in Copenhagen.
First of all, Copenhagen is do or die. Because in Bali, 2007, the United Nations made it a mandate that the continuation of Kyoto post-2012 should be decided this year in Copenhagen. So it's really do or die. The provisions of Kyoto do go up in a puff of smoke, like Cinderella at the touch of 12. This is true. What are the issues that make it most difficult? There are two. Because if we solve these issues, the rest will come to pass. Number one, in most generality, is the perennial confrontation between the rich and the poor nations, the North-South emissions debate. Developing nations are 80% of the world economy, but they emit only 40%, with 60% of the emissions coming from the wealthy nations that have 20% of the people, and responsible so far for most of the emissions. On the other hand, China is the second largest emitter, 18% of all the world emissions. And the developing nations are now rapidly developing. So everybody knows in 20 years they hold the Trump card. Predominant and perhaps most acute is the relationship between the two geopolitical powers in the North and the South. The North, the US. The South, China. You can see this North-South conflict being played out as a proxy, as what amounts to a cold war on emissions between China and the United States. And it really could be a protracted cold war scenario like we had last century between Russia and the US. That's the way I see it. That's the way many people see it. So we need to resolve and diffuse the cold war between the US and China, which is all about warming. The second issue is, once we solve the agreement so that we don't have the standoff, which is diplomatic and is political, geopolitics, we still have to pull up our sleeves and do something about the carbon in the atmosphere. Now, this is even more difficult than the first. Now, reducing emissions won't do. We physically have to reduce carbon in the atmosphere, go carbon negative, not just stabilize emissions, go negative. It's the only thing that will prevent us from going up 3, 4, or even 5 degrees, which are catastrophic, potentially catastrophic. So these are the two huge challenges. Number one is the political standoff between China and the US. Number two is the real issue about how to recover when we are at the point of no return.
Graciela Cicholneski there, Professor of Maths and Economics at Columbia University, speaking to The Guardian's environment correspondent, David Adam. Guys, just a quick thought from you. We're going to have much more on Copenhagen in future podcasts and in endless articles on the website, which I'm sure our listeners will eagerly lap up. But a quick thing from you. Copenhagen, we probably over-talked this a little bit, but Robin, what's your sense from what Graciela said there? What are the sort of things that we actually have to get out of this, given that we might not get an actual political deal or legal deal out of it?
I think people just have to come up with numbers, and the numbers won't meet, and then you've got a rough agreement and you go back over the next 6 months and hammer those numbers out. By numbers, I mean amounts of reductions in carbon emissions.
So actual, you have to do it by this amount, otherwise it doesn't mean anything. There's no commitments on...
Everybody has to make some kind of proposal. Yeah.
Duncan?
Well, I think that's right. It's a numbers game, really. It's we need to have some clear parameters in terms of the rate of reduction. If we're going to see global emissions peak within the next few years, certainly by 2015, which is what the science demands, for us to have even a fighting chance of avoiding runaway climate change.
For more on Graciela's carbon trading concept, you can read her book, Saving Kyoto, which is out now. That's all for this week, folks. Thanks to The Observer's Robin McKee and also Duncan Clark, whose latest book, The Rough Guide to Green Living, is out now. Don't forget to add your voice to the debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jar. Next week, astronomy journalist and author Stuart Clark is back in the pod. So let us know if you've got any questions for him.